Now, he's very popular today among a lot of people who haven't read it. That's part of the story. Pigeons like all sorts of things you can't say. McLuhan's books, a chapter is nothing else quite does the philosophy of the pigeon population. They're very badly written. Words are used irresponsibly in private context. Phrases are tossed off with more concern for their impact and their meaning than one of them. The ablative absolute backside, he calls it the chair. Extension of the posterior, the ablative absolute backside. I got captains in here, especially on your lap. What does it mean? You get the impression that Skinner is concerned more to condition you than to persuade you. Language, words, which have been considered, at least since the time of Socrates, demand supreme cultural competence. Language. This is explicitly called obsolete. Careful, sustained argument. McLuhan dismisses this as an outmoded remnant of the era of print technology. I'm picking on the later McLuhan because I do think that his book, The Gutenberg Galaxy, is well worth reading. It's too badly written. But here McLuhan was really trying to reason with us and trying to show us something that's happened to us. But apparently, pigeons don't read, so nobody's caught on, so he tried understanding media, and that did a little better because that was a little less responsible. And finally, the medium is a massage, and it's strictly a snow copper condition. I'm appraising McLuhan on the basis of his later efforts, and I'm being unfair to McLuhan, but I don't think I'm being unfair to the cult of McLuhan. One of his most revealing aphorisms, McLuhan said, print technology created the public. Electric technology created the masses. He's a math man. Print, books, that created the public. But television and electric technology created the math man. The passive receptor, the manipulable object, or the pigeon. McLuhan continues, the public consists of separate individuals walking around with separate fixed points of view. The new technology demands that we abandon the luxury of this posture, this fragmentary outlook. And notice all the elements. First of all, technology demands that it is our master. We must obey. Haven't we so often turned over the responsibility for deciding in which direction we ought to go to the scientists and technologists? That they are armed with some special magic. And once they have invented something, once they invent a way to go to the moon, we must go. These are our magicians. And what do the magicians require? That we give up the luxury of having a point of view. That means give up the illusion of rationality and submit to having our opinions molded by the mass media. Is it luxury to have what McLuhan calls a fixed point of view? I do not mean, and he doesn't mean, a dogmatic, unchangeable point of view. Or is it discipline, hard work, to have a point of view? I think it's hard work. What's the alternative to having a point of view? The alternative seems to me to be vagueness. It's not, the alternative is not an open mind. But an empty mind. McLuhan writes, electric circuitry is orientalizing the West. The contained, the distinct, the separate, our Western legacy, are being replaced by the flowing, the unified, the fused. Or the fuzzy, in other words. The new virtue in the Gospel according to McLuhan is mental inebriation. Be mentally stoned at all times. Let our thoughts be goo, which is the sound of suspiciously like one pigeon. McLuhan speaks endlessly about the extension of man's nervous system through electric technology. He writes, the world is a village and we participate in everything. The pigeons do seem to be everywhere. But do we really participate in everything? canvas. Only if participation means faint impression, flitting engagement, a fleeting concern, we get momentarily interested a little bit in all kinds of things. That's true. But is that participation, is that involvement? Television helps us suppose that we participate in everything. It bombards us with sensory stimuli, and we get a little bit, the news all around the world comes to us immediately, and we know that they're rioting in Bangkok tonight. We find out right away. But do we participate in that? Are we really involved? Do we really understand what's going on? Do we stand in anyone's shoes? I'm reminded again of the pigeon. He has wings, you see. That enables him to believe that he's on top of everything in the public library. And you know what he does on top of it. It seems to me that electric technology, in fact, fosters ignorance and apathy through sensory overstimulation. It displaces the distinctively human capacity of reason and lulls us into accepting a situation by suggesting that we're well-informed. There's a little cartoon that McLuhan reprints in the meeting with Masada, two girls walking out of a high school classroom. One of them says, "I don't mind current events, except that there's so many of them lately." The phenomena that McLuhan is talking about and that he's celebrating, he is celebrating, seem to me to be both cause and effect of the pigeonization of man. But they come to us, especially in McLuhan's writing, cunningly disguised as instruments for the extension of our powers. I think they're instruments for the crippling of our powers if we do not watch them very carefully. Surely, I'm not saying television cannot be an extension of man. That television can also be an amputation of man. And I wish that McLuhan's summary in his writings would remind us that many of these things that he's talking about were developed and pioneered by Herr Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's minister of propaganda. But we aren't reminded of these things because we're not supposed to inquire the matter of substance. You know, the medium is the massage, and be there with content. Now, you might say, well, I don't watch TV. I insulate myself from it. I turn the thing off. That is a marvelous quality control device. That little button is off. But McLuhan said you don't have any right to do that. You have no right to insulate yourself from electric technology. Preserve your obsolete humanity by preserving your private life of thought and feeling by saying, I don't care what the television commentator is saying. I'm thinking this through for myself. Because McLuhan writes, we are suddenly eager to have things and people declare their beings totally. You've got to be involved, or you're just out of it, you're phony, you're obsolete. McLuhan wants total exposure. That's the good word. There's no such thing as indecent exposure, because all exposure is good, and total exposure is best of all. So you have the notion now that the proof about anyone, say a figure, a prominent figure in public life, the real truth about him, if there is such a thing as truth, is what we find out when we peer over the walls of his prison, you see. When we find out, you know, what he did when he was back in high school in a weak moment, we find out the little details of his, you know, he blows his sack, or the cult, the mass magazines, they go into this because they're losing circulation. The real truth about. And then what they give us is all of the sordid details that they can dig up about man's life. And this is the essence of it. But Marshall McLuhan isn't afraid of this at all. So everybody's peering into everybody else's bathroom. Marshall McLuhan has faith, because he says, I have faith in the ultimate harmony of the world. That's an interesting statement. Because what's left to be harmonized in a world where there are no points of view, no personal outlooks, no private creativity, no human effort to come to terms with the human situation? The harmony that McLuhan anticipates seems to me to be the harmony of the undifferentiated glob, the harmony at the end of history. When history has come to an end because man, its maker, has given way to the pigeons. It's a marvelous harmony among pigeons. or a rock among them, and they all fluff up together and sort of, they never bump into each other. But you know, there's a popular slogan of our day that seems to run counter to all of this. You often hear it said, but more people today are better educated than ever before. People are more knowledgeable, more sophisticated, more rational. Why, we are living in the midst of a knowledge explosion. You've all heard that. Well, I submit we're not. What we are living in is the age of information explosion. And there's a big difference between information, which is the kind of thing you can use to win money on a quiz show or to answer multiple sort of examinations, and knowledge. Knowledge requires effort, self-discipline. Knowledge is mastery. Knowledge results, it seems to me, and maybe this is just the way I'm using the term, but it seems to me there's a distinction in reality here to which I'm trying to point. Knowledge results when reason imposes order upon information. Knowing is something that is active. Knowing is making, it is doing. But the receipt of information is passive. It is pigeon-like. A computer receives information, but it has no knowledge. A computer can rearrange the information that you feed into it, but it rearranges it strictly in accord with a program that's previously been fed into it as pieces of information. So that, as the computer men like to say, garbage in, garbage out. There's an incentive, but that is not true with man. With man, garbage in, knowledge can come. If we don't think of ourselves as nothing but computers. I think it's highly characteristic of our age that we recognize no distinction between information and knowledge, or that we are fascinated by the analogy between the computer and the human brain. A lot of things being written today that you're working around this analogy. Another sign, coming back to what I started with yesterday, the university today, another sign of failure to recognize the difference between information and knowledge is what Ortega called the barbarism of specialization. Education today is horribly fragmented. But few people really care. For example, everyone says, well, the real problem is the problem of the city. So you want to, suppose you're in college, you want to know something about the problem of the city. You go over to the economics department, because you know economics, and they give you economic analysis. And you say, now what does this mean for the city? And they say, oh, well, you're asking questions beyond the scope of economics. These are political questions. So you've gotten a few tools, maybe, and a few pieces of information. But you have no understanding of the city. So you trot over to the political science department, and they explain about the structure of government and political processes and lobbies and how people vote. And you say, all right, no, but what are we going to do with the problems of the city? And they say, oh, well, you're getting into questions of sociology. So you trot over to the sociology department, and they explain to you about Mena and Shaman and I don't forgot all my sociology. But, you know, they tell you about structures and patterns of peer group participation, and they tell you that 16 boys who commit murder together are more closely welded into a bond than 16 boys who don't, and all kinds of other things. And you say, but now what does all this mean for the problems of the city, the economic problems? And say, you're asking ethical problems. So you trot over to the religion department. Or maybe, no, you go first to the philosophy department, and they ask you, they teach you what it means to make a moral judgment. And they get you into deontological logic. And they employ symbols to explain the peculiar structure of different forms of disguised imperative statements. And you say, but what ought we to do? They say, my task is only to clarify what you mean when you ask, what ought we to do? They say, you're asking a religious question. So you run over to the religion department, and they are parsing Greek verbs. But finally they say in the religion department, they say we must be ultimately concerned. However, religion provides only the ultimate concern. The special sciences provide the knowledge with which we must solve these problems. So you have to go over to the economics department. And the problems fall in the gaps between the disciplines. Now, and few people really care. This is what bothers me. We sit in the faculty club, and we get talking about these things. And the people who do care, and everybody was pinned down over lunch cares, but the trouble is to do anything about it would disrupt this, these private little universes that we've all built for ourselves. None of us is an authority
on interdisciplinary questions. And if we just build up our little special bailiwicks, we can preserve them against all comers, and when someone criticizes the relevance of what we're doing, we can say, well, you're just a layman, you don't understand, and we all go on building up our little models, and it never comes to anything. A pigeon's roost is his cattle, that's the philosophy. Well, but now sometimes when somebody says, but we got to integrate. We got to integrate, and they integrate by putting together a book of readings. Every publisher puts them out like a dozen. Now, but what happens? You look at them. They're snippets of information. They're snatches of argument from every point of view. A welter of opinions. You put them all together between paper covers, and you call them readings and the problem of yakety-yak, and you're supposedly have a tool for the education of the young. But what are you teaching the young? You're teaching the young that the truth lies somewhere in the middle. That's all. You got a real serious problem. Should we pass an open occupancy ordinance? So you have somebody arguing vehemently and for it. And you can detect he's cheating, his arguments aren't sound, he's so much in favor of it, he's using every rhetorical device to get his point across. And then you turn and you read a similar argument on the other side, where somebody's cheating and just trying to propagandize you. Then you tell the student the truth lies somewhere in the middle. Oh, hogwash. The question is where in the middle? The truth always lies somewhere in the middle. And maybe it doesn't. One of my favorite analogies, one of my students have learned that if there's any statement that I react against, is that when I ask them, well, what do you think? And they say, well, the truth lies somewhere in the middle. Turn red. I like to use the analogy of, but see, they always say, well, some people say. And I'd say, some people, like in the United States, say you ought to drive on the right. Some people, like in England, say you ought to drive on the left. Does the truth lie somewhere in the middle? But you see, these books of reasons are saying to us, problems are no longer to be mastered by students through disciplined thought or clarified through the dialogue of engaged and creative minds. Problems are to be drowned in a sea of committee reports, selected quotes, and similar trivia. You just heap up information, and then you drown the problem. And our society is so marvelously effective at the multiplication of trivia. Here is where McLuhan's technological thesis is very relevant. Technological processes for the efficient, low-cost accumulation of data or storage, scrambling, transmission, replication, dissemination of information, processes for doing all this have created the possibility, and the decline of reason has done the rest. So today we are drowned in a flood of books, pamphlets, magazine articles, journals, newspapers, mass mailings, surveys, data, summaries of data, exposés. Studies today are in print almost before the events they describe occurred. Sometimes it is before. Newspapers have been caught with reviews of concerts out on the streets before the concert has been formed. Which is, you know, part of the rush to be first with the information. You just look at the books that are out first. They are nothing. They're just trivia. The Gallup and Roper polls, by showing us how we will vote, make it unnecessary for us to vote at all. It's certainly unnecessary to think. You want to know how to vote, vote for the winner. It's all predetermined anyway. In the age of the information explosion, thinking is unnecessary. And those who would like to think, because they don't believe that they are pigeons, are distracted by the information bombardment. those people who would like to think in our society are continually being distracted by having more and more information thrown at them. There's always somebody yelling, we need more data. You can't say that just because all the data aren't in. All the data are never in. But we have to make judgments, and data will never be a substitute for judgment. The question is, are the relevant data in? Well, what is relevant in? Relevant means nothing.
Mike, will you wake that kid up tonight?
He turns off.
We're kind of having a lecture here.
Well, you see, you could argue that that's relevant information. to a pigeon, it is, because every stimulus is relevant to a pigeon in his Skinner box. So if you think that man's just a pigeon, then it's never time to think. And nobody wants to read books that require them to think. And we just keep waiting for more data to feed in the hope that some out of all this time is the right button will be pushed and we will respond the correct way. But now, if you come back to what I was talking about yesterday in particular, the political life of pigeon, I think you can see how this all works itself out. Politics, in the most general sense, I would define as that, it's a very general definition of politics, that set of activities through which separate organisms are accommodated to one another. That's politics, that set of activities through which separate organisms are accommodated to one another. I'd like to suggest that there are three basic styles of politics. That's three basic ways for achieving accommodation of conflicting interests among organisms. One is fighting. Might makes right, the strongest rules. You all wrestle, and when either somebody beats everybody else up or is recognized as the strongest, he could beat everybody else up, he rules and he imposes order. The second alternative is external control. The warring organisms invite somebody to come in, a dictator, benevolent or otherwise, and have him enforce power. And the third alternative is internal control, where the organisms accommodate to one another, give and take. But this presupposes rationality, the power of self-transcendence, of seeing yourself, getting beyond yourself, and seeing yourself as one among the group. And just, sure, you are most interested in yourself. That's inevitable. You've got your private point of view. But you can still transcend yourself and see that other people are men like you are, with the same kind of rights. This presupposes the concept of truth. This third style of politics is accommodation through continuing rational discussion. And the third style, of course, is the essence of liberal democracy. Well, what I was sort of suggesting yesterday is that we have given up on style three and we've sold out to one and two, fighting and benevolent dictatorship. What are our politics? I so often, my friend, some of you were here the other night, Monday night, when I made the comment that I was a little bit disturbed at how often these students were saying, I believe, in my opinion. Now, that all sounds very humble and all that, but I wonder if they really have a point of view. That's what was bothering me, or whether they're willing to give up their point of view as soon as somebody shouts a little bit louder. Or what they mean by saying I have a point. Why do they hold this? Are they giving causes or reasons? This is a typical kind of discussion that goes on in some of my classes. I ask a question like, I mean, this is one of the open occupancy law. I'll ask my students, should we have an open occupancy law in this country? And they're two answers, yes, no. But then I ask, why? Well, I say to the student at the end, he says, because I'm against it. I say, oh, you believe we shouldn't have one because you're against it. I said, why are you against it? They said, well, it takes away a man's right to do what he wants to do with his property. All right? Should a man have the right to do whatever he wants to do with his property? I think so. Why do you think so? Because those are my values. I said, well, does everyone share your values in this case? No. Are your values right? Well, I think so. I said, why? Because that's the way I believe. I said, but should you believe that way? Are you right? Or should you re-examine your values and perhaps change them? And I get a puzzled look. How can anybody change his values? That's the way I was brought up. Other people have different values. That's the way they were brought up. I don't say I'm right, but that's the way I feel because that's the way I was conditioned. I'm against or for something because of the way I have been conditioned. So you see, I have students sometimes in class, I teach down in Texas, and I have two students who are victims of racial prejudice, And marvelous, frightening thing is that they're aware of it. And they say, well, I'm prejudiced. What a funny statement. I am prejudiced. If you just listen to that. Someone would say, I am prejudiced, means that I am stupid. Huh? That's what it means. I am prejudiced means I make a judgment before I have any basis for making that judgment. How can a person say he is prejudiced? You almost think there's deliberance in the very act of saying. You say, I was prejudiced. In the act of admitting it, you escape from it. But no, they say, I am prejudiced. They say, Negroes are just as good as everybody else, but I wasn't conditioned to believe that, and now I can't escape. Just like pigeons in Skinner Bob. My responses only have causes in the past. I can never give a reason for anything. Everything about me is conditioned, so what can I do? Yes, of course, there's nothing you can do except fight. If you really feel strongly, you fight. The disagreements among us are unimportant, of course, we ignore them, but if they are important, if the outcome really matters, then we fight. The stronger wins. And that's political style number one. So you ask the question, well, is it right to pass an open occupancy law? People say, let's wait for November and see. We don't believe that, do we? That the majority is always right? We don't believe it, but we've accepted it. Did we have no other way to see what the information is? Well, at the same time, this is happening, though, and we're also experimenting with political style number two, external control. You know, we don't like fighting. Fighting is uncomfortable. It interferes. It dirties up the cage and all of that. So, we allow benevolent despots to condition us into harmony. I think that's a pretty valid interpretation of politics in this era of image mongers. Politicians no longer have positions. They have images. They don't reason, they posture. What is it that makes a candidate? It's the way he combs his hair, a broad smile, a face full of teeth, a frank and earnest stare, a snappy slogan. I'm deeply disturbed by how good looking our presidential candidates have become. And golly, you don't like them, huh? Well, I mean, they're a lot better looking than they used to be. If somebody comes up on the political scene who's, old enough to be trusted, but looks young and flashy, he's automatically vaulted into prominence. Mayor Lindsay in New York City, I think, is a good example. I'm not attacking Mayor Lindsay, maybe a fine man and all that. But face it, he was vaulted into prominence because he was youngish looking and handsome. I think Hubert Humphrey, chief deficiency is his prominent jaw. Well, anyway, this is the stuff that makes presidents and senators and congressmen in this day of politics by the advertising people. We're not reasoned with. There's no serious public discussion. Everyone just hunts frantically for the golden kazoo, the gimmick. The right bell to ring that will make us salivate on election day over the proper lever of Bluff's dogs or Skinner's pigeons. I don't want to make any comments about people who can't. I would just say in general, show me a candidate who is trying to reason with the American people, and I'll show you a candidate who's going to lose on election day. The rational men have been pushed from the picture. It's the era of the mass man. And the pigeons expect to be conditioned by positive reinforcement fed them through their television sets. And if there are any people around to protest, well, you know what pigeons do to people. one last point on all this. It's the current cult of youth. I think this also demonstrates what's happening. It's terribly hard to say what I want to say about being misunderstood. But consider the slogan, the popular slogan, they don't trust anyone over 30. Now, to begin with, I think this is a legitimate warning to youth, especially on college campuses. We over 30, I think, are so often held prisoner by our accumulated prejudices and our vested interests and our
intellectual and moral laziness, which keeps it from even an inkling that the accustomed and comfortable ways may not be the best, that I think there's reason for youth to be suspicious of anyone over 30. And especially in the educational system, which is terribly conservative, dominated by bureaucrats. I think we have a tendency to put students through the same regime through which we went, because we said, if that regime's no good, then I'm not an educated man, because I went through it. So it must be good for you. So there's a legitimate warning in all of this, and I'm very excited about some of the real ferment among students about the goals and the means of education. But it's a long, illogical, and fateful leap from this to the proposition that those under 30 do know, that they can be trusted, that they have more of the answers than the graybeards. An age in which this can be seriously maintained, even by those who are over 30, and this is the important thing, the youth have always felt that they had all the answers that they knew. You know the old saying, when I was 16, I thought my father was stupid. It's amazing how much he learned in 15 years. You youth have always felt that they had it all, that they knew the answers. But what is novel today is that the no longer young are beginning to agree. Like Marshall McLuhan, he says, youth has got it by the tail. They understand. They're directly involved. They're not fragmented by print technology. An age in which this can be seriously maintained, I think, bears witness to a fateful moral flaw, that it has rejected all standards. If you concede wisdom to those who have had no time or opportunity to acquire wisdom, you imply that there is nothing to be learned. History is a mere tale told by an idiot. That intellectual discipline is only busy work for those who happen to like that sort of thing. That the rational aspect of the vast human enterprise is of little, if any, importance. And that, I'm afraid, is widely believed today. And it seems to me to be a quite appropriate creed for people disposed to think of themselves as merely complicated pigeons. And what pigeons want is contentment. I need to know. Come to psychology. As soon as I finish. I didn't know about being in the interview. I think what we are after today, we Americans more than anything else, is contentment. And I'll make a very heretical statement. I suspect, and I guess I suspect it because I see it in myself, that those people who are trying to stir up discontent, as for instance about our policies in Vietnam or our racial policy, suspect that what they really want is for all of this to go away so that they can be content. You know, a nagging conscience makes you uncomfortable. I suspect that many of us liberals are really saying, I want to do something about the problems of the inner city because I can't really enjoy my suburban life when I'm aware of those people down there who do not have what I have. Let's make the world smooth and contented, and then I can be content myself. But there is in man, I'm convinced, something that has been properly called divine discontent. And this is a part of being human. It's a part of being rational. To perceive the difference between what is and what might be, between what you are and what you might become, and what other people are and what they might become. This is the discontent that has produced science and technology and that produces every great human endeavor. But we are in danger of identifying discontent with mere discomfort. And you can remove discomfort. You see, once again, college students doing this. They claim that they're expressing divine discontent and really trying to make the world better because they want better cafeteria meals and fewer 8 o'clock classes and easier tests and girls willing to put out. In short, improved living conditions or better roosts. But discontent is uniquely human. And I do not think you can remove discontent within human history.
It's the mark of the rational soul. It's what makes it men. And those who say they will make us comfortable are to be watched. Man demands something more than comfort, unless he's fit. Well, that's...
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Has there ever been a time in the history of our country that you feel that the people have excelled in the beliefs that you've been talking about this morning?
There's a twofold answer to that. Perhaps the majority of people have never been the kind of excellent men convinced of their rationality and determined to engage one another in dialogue that I'm talking about. But at the same time, they have not insisted that they were capable of ordering and governing society. This is what Ortega calls the revolt of the mass. Because most men have always been mass men. That's perfectly all right. But the revolt of the masses constitutes their insistence that they have a right to control society and to control culture, to decide what's going to be done with the whole of society. And Ortega says, these people are incapable of determining their own lives, much less that of society. Most men throughout history have taken their cues from the excellent men. They have revered excellence, the man of virtue, the man of self-discipline. But that is no longer true. However, I would even suggest, on the basis mostly of reading Alexis de Tocqueville, that 100 years ago or more, a much larger percentage of Americans were excellent men than is true today. For complicated reasons, I couldn't explain if I wanted to. But whether or not the second half of my answer is correct, I would hold the first half. It's sort of this way. Maybe college students, as they entered college, have always been semi-pigeonholed. But it used to be that when they came to college, they said, now, I am going to learn. But some of the best minds entering college, they do not come intending to learn, but to teach. I had a student who had a real profound disappointment to me. I often think of him. Real sad. In fact, I had him as a freshman. He was a bright guy, an engaging person, creative. He got involved right away in student politics and student press, and he was an agitator throughout college. And he was up all night editing the school newspaper, writing articles, or singing protest songs. And he was getting everyone involved. He was always attacking apathy, and he was always sleeping in class. He never read the assignments. He couldn't. He admitted, I don't have time. I'm so involved with things. But Paul, one of the things you ought to be involved in is learning something. But he didn't feel that it was necessary to learn anything in order to solve the problems of the world. See, he thought that it's all just a matter of a good heart, something like that. And he had a good heart, so he was ready to go. And all he had to do was get other people's hearts right. And you do this by conditioning, by blasting them with editorials and putting up posters and marching and protesting. But when it comes to reasoned discussion of issues, he picked up the phrase, unfortunately for me, paralysis of analysis. That I got, old phrase. But I spoke with this once, and he liked that. Paralysis of analysis. That it's not time to think, it's time to act. Now that's a good thought for a college student to have when he's a junior or a senior. But with a freshman, I think it's time to learn. It's time to think and to learn how to think.
Is it the right of a student at a university to act?
Within the limits of law and the regulations of the university, sure.
This is within the university itself, not external to the university.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, like Columbia, where they are actually engaging in outside activities, or actually activities that have no concern to them, of a political nature.
Well, it is a concern to them, obviously.
It is a concern, certainly it's a concern to everybody. All problems are, supposedly. But is it the concern of a university? I mean, you reflect the attitude of a university if you react while you are going to this university. Isn't a university a place of learning?
Yeah.
Shouldn't then the university be used only for the training, not for action?
I couldn't buy that. In fact, you see, the university is more than a place of learning. The university is always also a power structure. It's an institution that engages in economic and political activities. The purchase of land, the erection of buildings, lobbying for particular federal grants, and so on. So a university is more than an institution of learning. Now, I think all these other activities in which the university engages, this political structure, should be judged, and be continually judged in the light of their contribution to the essential task, which is the promotion of inquiry, learning, dialogue. But let's face the fact, universities are political structures. And Columbia University was moving in the political realm, and the students did not like the way it was moving, did not like the impact it was having on the community. And I think we should all be perfectly clear that Columbia has a long and dismal record in this respect. This goes way, way back. And many, many responsible people have been criticizing Columbia for a long, long time for attempting to create a little ghetto up there on Morningside Heights. And in the process, seriously diminishing the chances of the surrounding community for maintaining its integrity. So there were very real issues here, and I think that the student protest was well-founded. I certainly think that a student has a right to protest this kind of thing. How he protests is another matter. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yesterday you were you made it quite definite that you were very much in favor of what Martin Luther King had done, the way he did it. Now we're up here in the Midwest, I was wondering, from what we hear in the papers and the way it's presented to us, whether you think the followers of him doing as he did. I mean, I think that the press is...
Why don't the rest of you answer that question? I've been so far away from the newspapers in the last few weeks.
I have
weeks,
too, but I mean, Mr. Abernathy, mm-hmm. Pastor Abernathy, has been jailed. Of course, Martin Luther King was too. But I feel some of his followers haven't added to what he's tried to accomplish. They sort of made more problems.
Well, let me not answer that. You are, some of you are better informed on this than I am.
So has anybody seen a paper in the last week?
Yeah.
What are you trying to ask?
What I want to know is if Martin Luther King's followers, the ones that have taken over his what he's been trying to do, are doing as well as what yesterday's call was quite.
I think the people that he was trying to sway have got so content, so used to what he was doing that no longer bothers them, therefore demonstrations aren't going to work.
Well, the one that he did wasn't Abernathy, right? What was
This is probably the last demonstration that can remain peaceful if nothing is done about it. If nothing is done about the situation, so that the Poor People's March is probably the last campaign that has the capability of remaining peaceful.
Were there people put in jail too, or were they sent home and then
there was some 200 to 300 people who were jailed along with Reverend Abernathy for unlawful assembly on the Capitol grounds.
They just had to drag him out of there.
Seems to me that basically his idea was good, but the aftermath was always violent.
Well, has anybody made it, I mean, like President Johnson or Senator McCarthy or Humphrey, or, you know, any of these people running for president or in the presidency, you made a statement about this at all?
No, I
don't
know. Aren't they afraid to?
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like somebody's going to have to come out one way or another eventually in the political system, especially the candidates, about this important issue.
Notice one way or the other. There are only two points of view, and that's what we, you're either for them or against them. Unfortunately, I think that's why candidates don't make statements, because you cannot present to the mass man a subtle, reasoned, complicated position.
Necessary either, though. It seems that there are some issues that are pretty much for or against.
Yeah, but Gary, what would you say about this whole thing?
If I were a candidate or not?
Yeah, I mean, no, you.
Well,
for
or
against?
I think the people have a definite right to be heard, and I would have extended their permit to assemble.
The permit what?
Yes, but if you and I go on the ground, and you have lunch, they kick you off the ground. They say there's no sitting on the grass. And if you and I went up and had lunch at a picnic where they camping, we would
you didn't get a permit. They did.
Oh, all right.
Well, why were they arrested and the permit was extended and they were still
arrested? The permit was extended and the extension expired and it was thought advisable for the public good to not extend the permit a second time. Someone had to make a decision, and this was the decision that was made and that was the decision that was carried out.
But evidently nobody's listening to them, really.
Well, they will now. I mean, it seems like once you jail them, bunch of people like this, it makes big news. A lot more than it might have been. It's probably going to be better for the movement, you know, you get a few people in jail and it turns out a lot more.
No, I think the conflict, their object in keeping themselves in the news.
That's
so good has been done. However, when you talk, hear some of the statements that Abernathy made, was that he was slowly losing control and violence was sitting in more than he was losing the image of his perspective. And he was more or less, I think, even though he was arrested, relieved to have this taken out from under him right now. In other words, he's had his campaign has been changed, not by him.
The campaign
he
benefits
come back,
in two ways by
right,
the jailing.
He can always come back and keep pushing it and never be blamed now. And I think that the campaign themselves, his group, probably I think the group that was, what you might call the agitators in that, back in the two, of course, but I think
it would have been a real
happen in the future if something wasn't done.
It would have been a real shame, I think, for this poor people's movement if they had allowed a lot of violence to break out and then the whole country would say, well, you know, put them all in jail and you know, be tough with everybody. That would have probably worked out a lot better this way for them. So they have a righteous cause in the underdog.
The question that bothers me is, what do they want and what can we do? And this is so seldom discussed, and everyone is asked to choose a side. Are you for the Poor People's March or against it? I don't think we ought to be for or against the poor people's march. We ought to be for or against intelligent policy for dealing with the problems of our society. And these questions, what kind of legislation would be effective in accomplishing what goals? That's where discussion ought to be focused.
Yeah, but Paul, there's a deeper issue here. It seems like lots and lots of people have organization enough that they can lobby and get their legislation through, but many times there are segments of society, and the poor have commonly been one of these segments, they haven't had the organization or the power to be able to push their legislation, even though they might have quite a few in number. And it seems like this is a sort of an organizational kind of a...
If any definite legislative program is being offered or suggested by the protesters, I have never
he's written down, it seems to be a sort of blind focus in the hope that someone will develop a program for them in a particular situation. So, and there's a sudden demand that everything be accomplished right now, and they come with no recommendations as to exactly what shall be accomplished so that their protest will be satisfied.
Well, they just don't have much of a meeting. They don't have a high-priced lobbyist, paid lobbyists like other organizations, because this is their way of lobbying.
Lobbying for what? This is
something better. But
yeah, but what? You see, they just can't
get the government to propose anything. Either party will propose anything.
Now, just a minute. Abernathy proposed 24 priorities to the House of Representatives and the Senate and to the Department of Agriculture, and in which he named the goals of the campaign and for what they were marking. I don't know the extent of the substance as to programs, but at least the goals were there. And they weren't just marching against poverty. They at least had at least 24 definite goals.
I think that everybody's read in the papers about the little personal things, like Dr. Green says, about the little tidbits of personal life that have gone on in the Resurrection City, and everyone's seen the picture of the tricycle and the mud and that sort of thing. But how many times has the news media printed these 24 specific goals that they're looking for? I think part of our problem is that the mass media, the television, and the newspaper only pick up these little tidbits so that they think will be sensational, and will sell the papers and don't give us the sort of substance and the things that they should really be considering. Like Ron said, the 24 goals are there, but how many of them have read it? Everybody knows the other little
I confess that I was partially wrong in what he said, and I was glad that the young man corrected me. One of the goals that has been mentioned is equal job opportunities. Let's take that one for example. Now, are these people supposed to sit on the lawns in Washington, D.C. until equal job opportunities become a complete actuality all over this country? This is an impossibility. I worked quite actively in the areas where I do work to forge an equal job opportunity, but I just can't see that it can become an accomplished thing overnight while people are sleeping in the mud and the lawns in Washington, D.C. The protest is made, there's a time for it to be made, a time for it to end, and a time for constructive work to be done toward achieving equal job opportunities. There's no law Congress can suddenly pass while people are sleeping in the grass that is going to cause an equal job opportunity situation to spring full blown into being all over the United States. This is an impossibility. Meanwhile, all the grass will be dead.
I think that's something that's lacking in America today. There's too much push and pull, and too much I get a job if I've got a pull with the right people. I think that people should earn the opportunity to have the job they're able to do.
Well, it's about time to do our yoga exercises and then prepare to develop our personality for the last 5 days.